This is Chapter Day. I'm Jim Fleming. I'm reading from Little Hawk and the Lone Wolf, a memoir by Raymond Cuckatosh, published by the Wisconsin State Historical Society Press. He was born in 1924 on the Menominee Indian Reservation near Neopit, Wisconsin. He grew up surrounded by nature and the traditions of the Menominee. His older brothers have turned to drink, but Ray, in his early teens, is working with his mother to support the family and driving. Chapter 7. After searching a while for a suitable car, we found a light blue 1932 Chevrolet Coupe with spare tires on each front fender and a luggage rack behind the rumble seat. It was love at first sight and began my never-ending love affair with cars. Who needs women when you have a car like this? Whenever I polished or washed my car, my mother would say, "You're not working on that car, you're romancing it." And she was right. I even slept in it the first night. My mother put down a $35 deposit. The balance was $40, and we had to make monthly payments of $10. The logging camps were located about 4 to 10 miles from Neopit, and the lumberjacks were paid on the 1st and 15th of each month. They needed someone to pick them up and take them to the nearby towns. This was where I came in. I made 2 payments in 1 week. Now all I owed was $20. Lots of those old boys at the logging camps were robbed after they passed out, so they welcomed a young man like me who didn't drink and who would look out for them while they were drinking. One day I met the sheriff near a tavern, and he asked how my driving was coming along. I told him that I was taking care of some lumberjacks. He told me to be careful and watch out when they got drunk. "Don't let them steal your car," he warned me. Many people hired me to take them to the city to buy provisions. That Chevy got a workout, and people paid me $1 for the round trip. Gas was 10 cents a gallon. I was doing pretty well with Ray's taxi. The famous White House, of course, is where the president lives and where all our problems are supposed to be resolved. Men enter the White House with predicaments and leave with frowns on their faces. But the White House I'm talking about housed some of the most attractive ladies of the night in our area. This House of Pleasure was located near the city of Antigo, not too far from the reservation. And at this White House, men entered with an expression of anxiety and left with smiles that would take an undertaker 3 days to wipe off. The ladies of the night were meticulous about their appearance and what little attire they wore. Even their manners were admirable. These women showed their appreciation for my presence each time my old Chevy brought them a carload of lumberjacks. They would give me a candy bar, comic books, and soda. Most of them knew my name. Some even asked about my schoolwork. The madam, mistress of the brothel, displayed a fond affection for me each time I had the pleasure of meeting her. She smelled of perfume that made me gasp for air. She had such a benevolent regard for me that one day she handed me a present wrapped in a box with a bow on it. "Merry Christmas, Ray," she said, and I smiled and thanked her. She never told me her name, so I just referred to her as Ma'am. The madam could be ferocious when provoked, as I soon found out. When things go too smoothly, beware. My mother's old adage proved accurate again. One night we heard a roar of engines outside and looked out to see about 5 squad cars. The door burst open, and one agent hollered, "This is a raid!" Well, the first agent in the door tried to grab the madam, and she belted him so hard he flew clear out the door, only to be replaced by another. It took 4 agents to subdue her. Before they placed her in the squad car, one of the agents grabbed me by my arm and said, "Look, I got a kid!" "Let him go!" the madam cried, and then she hit him so hard he bounced off the wall. "How many men you got in there?" the sheriff asked me. 4, I answered. "Well, take them all to jail and wait for me there." As I left, I could see some of the men pulling up their long johns as they were pushed into waiting squad cars. As I passed the squad car where the madam was, she was still swinging at the agents. They probably wouldn't have had a workout like that if they'd cornered a black bear. To make matters worse, they were going to have a hell of a time explaining why they reeked of her perfume. I managed to get all 4 of my passengers out of jail before the night was over. They all paid their fines for disorderly conduct, $1 each, or about 1 day's pay. 2 days later, the White House was once again open for business. I know, because I took another bunch of lumberjacks there. The Green Roof in Shawano County was another house of ill fame. Everyone seemed to know about it. The lumberjacks had their choice of the White House or the Green Roof, and most preferred the latter. It was my job to get them there and back and look out for poachers, men who prey on other men for their money. One day, at the crack of noon, I was parked near the pay station, waiting for my first passenger, and I spotted a poacher. He was easy to recognize because he didn't have work clothes on. My first two customers sat in the front seat, and I asked them if they knew the guy. Both answered no. Well, we'd better keep an eye on him, I said, and they agreed. He approached my car and asked if I had room for another. I told him sure, but he had to pay first. He reached into his pocket and said, "All I have is a 20." I knew he didn't have a 20, so I told him to give me the 20 and I'd change it for him. He told me he'd be right back. We all laughed as he walked away. But to my surprise, he came back a few minutes later and handed me 50 cents. He got in the rumble seat. All I had to do was wait for one more customer. That didn't take long, and soon we were on our way to the first tavern. Before we went in, I told the two men to watch and see if that guy had any money. Turned out I was right. He didn't have enough to buy a beer. We dumped him right there. The Green Roof did not have a madam or mistress. It was operated by a man, and he was one mean SOB. I know, because I watched as he bounced many men out the door. He stood 6 feet tall and weighed about 200 pounds. First time I met him, he told me, "You can't come in here, boy." I looked him straight in the eye and said, "Well, then from now on, I'll take my passengers to the White House instead." He backed off. "You mean to tell me you brought me customers?" "Oh, four of them," I snapped. He scratched his head and said, "Well, I'll be." He pointed toward the bar and told me to go in. "Tell the bartender to give you anything you want." Once I was in the bartender looked at me and told me he couldn't serve me. Just then, the big man himself walked in and asked me why I hadn't gotten myself a Coke. I told him the bartender wouldn't serve me. "What?" he shouted, turning to the bartender. "Give him anything he wants. Don't charge him." Meekly, the bartender served me a Coke and some potato chips. After the men came down from upstairs, we headed for the door. As we were about to depart, the big man hollered, "Ray!" I ran back to see what he wanted. He bent down and took out a big roll of bills, peeled off one, and handed it to me. "Thanks," I said, with a big smile on my face. "I'll bring you another load this weekend." The big man smiled back. "You do that, and I'll make it right with you." My little Chevy was the talk of my peers. They all wanted to ride in it. They all also wanted to see my driver's permit. I didn't disappoint them. Now we could go to the lakes or to the nearest city for a movie. What more could a quiet little Indian boy ask for? A Saturday night dance in Gresham, that's what. Get some of the boys together, see what we could come up with. We would need a siphon hose to drain someone's gas tank while they were dancing up a storm. Good thinking, Ray. First, we would need enough gas to get there. Oh, well, it's only 10 cents a gallon. John's Smash was always good for a couple of dimes. Big Chevy, Harvey, could be counted on for another dime or two. When we got to the dance hall, all we had to do was wait until dark, position a lookout, and start siphoning gas. The Model A's were the easy ones, because they had tanks on the hood, behind and above the engine. We always displayed etiquette, never draining a tank completely. Leave enough for the man to get home. With a tank full of gas, we could go and fraternize with the pale faces, maybe even dance a couple of songs and hope it didn't rain. An Indian has to be careful, you know. And what's a Saturday night without a good fight? On this night, a polka band was whooping it up, and all the people were in the mood for action. One guy swung his girlfriend around and forgot to hold on to her. She fell, got up, took another guy for a partner, like nothing happened. Two girls were whirling around and around until they got dizzy and wound up under a table. Some old gal was dancing up a storm and her stockings fell down to her ankles. Back in the 30s, the dance halls didn't have air conditioning. On this hot summer night, everyone was starting to sweat. And no one had a deodorant. Then the real fun began. Smash goosed a gal and she turned and belted a guy behind her. He hit her partner, and then two other guys joined in the fight. Soon the whole dance floor was swinging, and it wasn't to the tune of the music. Smash headed for the door, followed by Harvey, and I started in the same direction. "Grab a few bottles on the way out," Harvey yelled, and I added, "Don't forget the Coke." Now what? We had enough gas to go to another dance hall, so we headed for the one on Highway 29, just east of Shawano. This place was a little more expensive. The lady at the front held her hand out and said, "It will cost you 5 cents." I pointed to the dance floor and told her, "I have to go get it from my mother. She's in the hall." She gave me permission, and I went in. Harvey and Smash sneaked in, too. And we met on the side of the dance floor, just in time to hear the band leader announce that the next dance would be Ladies' Choice. Well, we figured we'd better check on the car before someone drained our tank, so we headed outside. There, we caught two guys with their hose still stuck in my tank. I asked one of them how much gas he took. "Oh, none," he said. Harvey grabbed the hose and gas can, threw them on the rumble seat, and said, "Now they won't be draining any more tanks." Then he declared that he and Smash needed a few more beers, so Smash headed back to the dance and came back with a case. I opened the rumble seat. He dropped it in. "Where's my Coke?" I asked. He muttered an obscenity and went back to get me three bottles. Now all I had to do was dodge the drunk drivers on the way back home, a maneuver that felt like driving the wrong way on the expressway during rush hour. Finally, I dropped off Smash and Harvey. They poured out of the car and waved and said, "See you tomorrow." When I got home, my mother was still awake. She asked me where I'd been. "Working," I told her, and I got a full tank of gas. My wolf sniffed me and sneezed. "You don't smell so good," my mother remarked. "I know," I said. "I tangled with a hog." She gave me a mean look. "Better stay away from those pig pens." I was already wondering what was going to happen the next Saturday night when my mother said, "You'd better think about going back to school." At least there was one good thing about returning to school. This time, I wouldn't have to walk. When the fall semester of 1936 began, I started 7th grade at the high school in Kashina. I will always remember my first day there, thanks to the compassionate help of a girl named Clarabel. The teacher ordered me to the blackboard. With a piece of chalk in my hand, I stood there, waiting. Then the teacher said, "Raymond, write out an algebraic expression." To this day, I can still feel the tension I felt as I stood before the class, not knowing anything about algebra. But Clarabel was sitting close by, and she whispered some letters and numbers. I wrote them on the board. They were all correct. Clarabel was not only intelligent, but was the most attractive girl in our class. She was also the most affluent. She drove a brand-new black two-door Ford, and even gave me a ride in it one day. I admired her throughout high school, and still do to this day. Throughout my younger years, I regarded girls as frail people who could get hurt easily. They seemed so dainty to me, and all of them reminded me of my little sister, so I treated them all with respect and remained aloof. Then I met a girl named Dolores. She was tiny, and so was I. We were the smallest in our class, and this gave us something in common. Her face would put any movie stars to shame. Dolores was always polite and would dance with me at the school dances. We even shared a Coke or two. Another head-turner in my class was Roberta. Her grandparents had a home across the highway from ours. Roberta spent the summers with them, and we shared many happy hours swimming in the Wolf River. Roberta's grandfather had great respect for my driving ability. Many times I drove him to Shawano and Antigo. On one of those trips, we encountered two ladies of the night from the Green Roof. Both of them said, "Hi, Ray," and I said hello back. Grandpa Waukaw exclaimed, "They looked like ladies of the night." "They are," I explained. "They work at the Green Roof." "How do you know?" "Because I take all the lumberjacks there." He smiled and said, "Oh, for a while there, I was beginning to wonder about you." One of my teachers had told me not to park on the school grounds, so I always parked about a block from school. One day, when I looked for my car, it was missing. I had to walk home. I told my mother someone had stolen my car, and she said, "Ah, your brother must have taken it." I told her it had almost a full tank of gas. "That's why he took it," she added. This disgusted me, planting seeds of hatred toward my brothers. They never had driver's licenses, and every time they drove, they'd get drunk and wreck the car. I wondered how bad my car was going to get wrecked this time. Early the next morning, I heard a car pulled up to the front of the house. I quickly went to survey the damage. I noticed that a front tire was flat and the wheel was completely ruined. The ignition was torn up, and my radiator ornament was missing. So was the gas. It was a pathetic sight, and it made me sick and angry. When my mother saw the condition my car was in, she said, "I'll have a talk with him." I thought that was like giving a dog a bone for peeing on the carpet. When I asked my brother why he hadn't changed the tire, he told me, "I didn't feel like it." My anger grew. "You feel like helping me change it now?" I asked. He gave me a stern look and snapped, "Your car, you change it." With one flat tire and the ignition torn out, I decided to leave the Chevy parked until spring. I drained the radiator and the block and took out the battery. If my brother was too lazy to change a tire, he'd never have the motivation to fix the rest of the car, so I knew the Chevy would be safe. He often asked me why I didn't just change the tire, and I'd tell him, "I don't feel like it." This would get him annoyed. He just couldn't wait to wreck it, and I wasn't sure why. Then I realized that he must have been jealous. He'd never owned a car. Since the Kashina School was operated by the Catholic Church, Christmas was one of the highlights of the year. Naturally, we had to adhere to their religious methods, attending Mass, saying prayers before classes, and taking religious studies. The Mother Superior would have been proud of me. I never did learn when to correctly stand, sit, or kneel, though. I hope she'd forgive me for that. About this time, my mother told me she was thinking about buying another car. She had just enough to put a down payment on a 1931 Ford Model A coupe with a rumble seat. It wasn't as good as the Chevy, but good enough. I was soon back in the taxi business. I made $2 during the first trip, and the same amount for the second. The madam at the White House was glad to see me again. Even some of the ladies said, "Hi, Ray!" The big man at the green roof also remembered me and gave me a dollar each time I delivered 4 lumberjacks to his establishment. One day, I took my mother out to do some shopping in Antigo, and we encountered a couple of ladies of the night. They both smiled and greeted me. After they passed by, my mother scolded, "Those women!" I smiled, and I said, "I know." My mother asked me where I met them. "At the White House, where I take all the lumberjacks," I explained. "That's how I make $2 a trip." My mother wasn't very happy, but seemed relieved. The Model A got a workout during the fall and well into the next year. By that time, I had enough money to have it all paid for, but with 2 brothers at home who drank heavily and with no one to control them, how could we cope? Well, we couldn't. They did as they pleased. Starting in fall 1937, I attended school at Neopit. One day, while I was at school, my brothers took the car to Shawano. They bought some wine and got so liquored up they totaled the car. I was forced to walk to school again. Now what was I going to do? I started saving up for another one. This time, I was determined that my brothers were not to borrow it under any circumstance. Then, just before Thanksgiving 1938, we had a stroke of good luck. Melvin wanted to buy another car and sell his old one. I needed a car to get back in business, so we bought it. I had that car until the spring of 1941. I thought it would make it until that summer, but one day I returned from school to find it missing, along with my brothers. At the end of May, they still had not returned. We knew they had to be in jail, so Melvin drove me there. Both my brothers had been sent to jail for charges of public drunkenness, driving without a license, property damage, and resisting arrest. They needed bail money, so I told them I would work hard that summer to help bail them out. Instead, I used the money I saved to get the Model A fixed and drove it until they got out. When they were released in September, they asked me why I hadn't bailed them out like I promised. "Well, I had to get the car fixed so I could make the money," I told them. This didn't please them one bit, and I knew that they were planning on wrecking the car again. In September 1941, my eldest sister left home and went to the convent. With a heart full of sadness, I called for my wolf and walked to the riverbank. I sat there for a long time, thinking that maybe Mary, too, was fed up with all the drinking. I felt like crying and fought back my tears. Only girls cry. I thought my wolf understood my feelings. By that fall of 1941, I'd become more like a man and had lost my angelic voice. It was time for me to find out who I was. This was the time in my life when the boy in me died and the man in me came alive. What I'm about to relate was practiced by my family and wasn't considered traditional by many other Menominee Indians. Remember, my mother was a medicine woman who made most of her own rules. We held the annual medicine lodge, where no women were permitted to enter. The lodge was like a steam bath. It was there that we would fast and meditate. Early one morning, after I started speaking with a deeper voice, my mother said, "Raymond, you are about to find out what you are." I told her I already knew what I was, and I didn't need to know anything more. "Listen to me," she said sternly. "As of now, you are not to come into this house or eat or drink anything until you have a vision. Once you start, your first vision will be of food. Your next vision will shed light on what you are. Do you understand?" I nodded my head, and taking only the clothes I had on me, I left. Well, she was right. The first night, I did dream of food. The next day, I roamed the riverbanks and took long hikes to Camp Four Hill. Hoping to prevent any disturbance of my forthcoming vision, I stayed out of view of everyone. The second night, the insects kept me awake, but by morning I dreamed of a large bird. As I looked up into the clear blue sky, I noticed a hawk circling above me. It didn't move its wings much, just soared around for a long time. Then it started to dive, and just before it got to the ground, it spread its wings, stretching its feet out, and picked up a mouse. This was the vision I was looking for. That's when I knew what I was. Some people belonged to the wolf clan, some the bear clan, others the eagle clan. I knew I must be of the aviary, the bird clan, the hawk. When I got home, I told my mother the good news about my vision. "You are from the hawk family. You are now called Little Hawk," she said. With all this excitement, I forgot about my hunger for a while. But then I went into the kitchen. "Today you eat alone," my mother said. "Tomorrow you will feel like a new man. That is, if you don't already." I didn't know if I would feel like a new man. All I knew was hunger. And right about then, even a mouse was looking good to me. But she was right. I did feel like I had achieved something. At least I had a new name. Even my little sister remarked, "You look different." "It's because I'm hungry. I've been out for 2 nights without any food, and all I had to drink was river water," I informed her. I noticed my wolf was waiting for me on the steps of the back porch. He wagged his tail as I approached, seeming to say, "Welcome back." I sat beside him, and he hit me with his paw. I put my arm around him and said, "We must never kill a hawk." His tail swooshed, as if he understood. "You talking to that old wolf again?" my little sister asked. "Don't you know he can't understand you?" I told her he understood everything I said to him. She shook her head and walked away, saying, "You're both crazy." "Nope," I shouted back. "I'm a little hawk." And pointing at the sky, I added, "Someday I will fly like the hawk around those clouds." She just shook her head again, as if she couldn't understand. My 17th birthday had just passed, and already I was looking forward to my 18th so I could come home and get a job far away from my brothers. Cherry-picking time was over, and we had enough money to get the car fixed. Well, for a while, I drove to school, but I knew it was just a matter of time before one of my brothers would wreck the car. There's no way I could stop them, and they knew it. My anger at them had grown. Somehow my car stayed in good shape until December 7th, 1941. That was the day the Japanese did a good job of bombing Pearl Harbor. That was also the day my brother did a good job on my car. He got bombed and drove it into a ditch. "That's it. I've had it. I can't take it anymore," I told myself. When I announced to my mother that I was leaving home, she convinced me to stay until the end of the semester. Reluctantly, I agreed. In January, I heard of a place called Baraboo in south-central Wisconsin. Someone told me people there were being hired to work in a defense plant, where they made powder and rockets for the war. In spring 1942, I decided to hitchhike there and apply for a job. So I said goodbye to my wolf and left. It was the first time I'd left my wolf alone. I wondered how he would react to my absence. I wrote a letter home to my mother. She later told me that when Colonel smelled the letter, he knew it was from me. Little Hawk and the Lone Wolf, a memoir by Raymond C. Cockatosh, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. I'm Jim Fleming. I hope you're enjoying the book and that you'll be here again for Chapter Day.